This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
We go to another side of paradise. Please welcome Paul Blizzard and Julian Syra.
For a treat.
Who is not a fantastic cyclist, but has become one of the preeminent travel writers of his generation. He is nobody better than going to Britain, getting into the sort of the atomic structure of the place that he's watching, whether it's sociologically or intellectually or theoretically. He's fantastically good at doing the thing that he does. Seems that there's something lost with the club, can we start at the beginning? Because I associate you with cycling more than sailing. How did sailing come about? What was the idea that led to this trip, that led to this book?
Yeah, well, it's kind of... firstly, I suppose it's an openness to all things that came my way, and actually that change from being on roads and on a bicycle was really revelatory in itself. I mean, it's... really a fundamental shift to be on water rather than on land, and it might seem like an obvious thing to say, but even, say, looking at the map of the world, I've always seen it as these, you know, the blocks of yellow, ruddy brown, which is the terrain, and the blue stuff was the obstacle, whereas suddenly when you're on a boat, it's completely inverted, and actually the blue stuff is what you're interested in, and the ruddy brown's the obstacle. So it started out really just with a quite intriguing proposition from a guy from Luxembourg who was a film producer, saying that he wanted to chronicle the Mokken sea gypsies of the island of Surin in particular, which is on the border of Thailand and Myanmar naval border.
Where are we on the map?
How's that? Yeah. Does that mean I can really lose this, can't I? So I'd been approached by the filmmaker from Luxembourg who had this idea to show indigenous culture in its indigenous wisdom, the stories that it passes down through the generations, and also the threat that is posed to it by modern industrial society, whether that's oil and gas drilling or mass tourism.
So.
Really, before leaving, very very little, I suppose. I'd come across a few sort of key stories that are widely reported and some of their attributes that they're renowned for. So they've lived, the Mokken live on water. They go from island to island. They're often born on a boat, and there's an initiation of being put into the sea at birth. Mokken children are reputed to have better, I mean, not reputed, it's shown in tests that they have better eyesight underwater. They're exceptional free divers from underwater fishing. So there are these stories about the traditional culture and the sort of skills that had engendered in these people. The one thing that really brought them renown, however, was the Boxing Day tsunami of 2006 or 5, maybe?
Three.
I guess there's so many tsunamis. But they in this moment where the Indian Ocean was hit by the tsunami and so many land-based communities were wiped out across, you know, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Indonesia. The Mokken had the story of the laboon, which means wave that consumes all. And when the sea sort of retreats remarkably far out because of the quake out at sea, it had been passed down through the generations that this was the sign for a coming tsunami. And so on seeing that, this community of 200 people had all headed for higher land,
and everyone survived. So where you see the sort of advance, the technological seismic warning systems and alarms that often didn't really see what was going to happen and didn't see in time, certainly, this community that just knew to watch the water, essentially. Yeah, I mean, I think in the book it references the fact that actually, yeah, other animals reputedly sort of know, or I say animals, as well, yeah, elephants would have gone to higher ground in Sri Lanka. Dolphins were reported by fishermen to be swimming further out because that's the place to go. And so I think it is problematic where we liken the Moken, who are a people, they're a society, they're humans like us, they have their own sort of needs and hierarchies to their society, their social structure. To liken their existence as being at one with nature as if it was no different to animals and they just adapt to what fits in. But with that, there is an appreciation for their world. You know, they live on this beachhead. Their huts are made from the materials of the forest around them. They see the world and the beach as it happens, day in, day out. And there is that wonderful sort of attunement that develops between them and their environment, and then the stories that have been passed down from their ancestors and relatives. And it manifests itself in lots of different ways. There's such a strong oral tradition of people just exchanging stories and news and information. And we obviously have our internet and we have our phones in every pocket, but actually there's something really nice about this woven fabric of the stories that get exchanged back and forth and the understanding that has helped these people develop of their world. Yeah, something like that. In Search of Wisdom, or something. In Search of Wisdom, I think, was the one.
Right, yeah. Your role is in this film production company?
Well, I mean, as you perhaps capture this, and as you'd expect with a Luxembourger getting in touch off of the internet saying, come and work with me in Southeast Asia, it was like pretty like madcap and wild card. He'd read articles of mine, and he'd loved them, and wanted me to be a part of it. And my... Yeah. The way that I look at the world is often kind of, it's informed by capital, it's informed by economics, it's often informed by who are the powerful people in the world and who are the less powerful people in the world. And when you're talking about indigenous people and first peoples who are often getting shunted around on their land or off of their land or on their water, in the case of the Moken, that kind of sense of rights and human rights, essentially...
Yes, quite.
I think he really had liked my approach in terms of making these issues a rights-based issue where you look at people and how the modern world is essentially marginalising them. You know, they have a way of life and a tradition that is sacred. They actually have much lower demands that they place on the world than we in the West do in terms of, you know, the number of resources in every single phone, in all of our clothing, in our cars, in our oil and gas, in the aeroplanes that fly us to these places. And yet the modern world makes more allowances for us to live these very demanding lifestyles, you know, very resource-intensive lifestyles, than it makes for the Moken to, you know, fish for a little bit of surplus and then to sell that surplus to trade for medicines or food supplies, you know. So there's that fundamental unfairness, I think, that we often see in indigenous peoples. And I think Reinhard, as a writer, wanted me to chronicle that. And if in the circumstance that the documentary had a script, he wanted me to write that. So it's kind of... To be the pen behind the lens, slightly, was my task.
Pen behind the lens, I like that. So you fly out there, you do a fantastic description of the tourism Southeast Asia that we know, the Koh Samois, the Koh Phi Phis, the drunkenness, the beaches, all that sort of stuff. You must have had your own sort of emotional reaction to what you were going to see, this First Nation, indigenous people who are living life much as it's been lived for 500, 600, 700 years, however long.
Yeah.
What did you actually find?
I mean, it's a mixture, for sure, and there are the moments of great wisdom. You know, you have the guy...
One second. Is there any chance that we can get the hammering to stop? Thanks.
It's like being back on the beachfront with the huts being constructed around. It's certainly a mixture of things, and you do get this wonderful, and you know, sometimes it's a bit cliche the way we talk about this indigenous wisdom, it gets over-essentialised, and but there's stuff there as well. You know, I would have spoken to a fisherman who I remember saying that, like, they asked how old he was. He said, "They say that I am 45, but I cannot be that old, otherwise I would be wiser." You know, but nevertheless, saying things like, you know, we know not to. A fish won't bite a cold hook. There are fissures in the rocks under the ground that allow fresh water to come out into the sea that you can actually drink from.
Right.
Or that the Thai fishermen will always want a Mokken person on the boat because the Thai don't know how to watch the water properly. Right. And all of these small things that, might be a fish jumping from the surface into the water in a certain way that throughout their life they've just become so accustomed to that they are really wonderfully and admirably at one with their environment. Then you get other, you know, the problems of modernity arriving there. So, I mean, and it was very morally wrong as far as I'm concerned, but the production crew had a bottle of bourbon them. And they just saw it as we shouldn't patronise the indigenous people because actually people in the West get drunk and fall over all the time as well. So why shouldn't these people? They like it. Which I understand that in one respect, but in another sense, I feel when you go to a place, you have a duty to be more mindful of your responsibility to sort of do no harm kind of thing. So there are problems with alcoholism.
You write very eloquently about the chief of the village, the Mokken chief, who is living at the end of the sort of village in the largest house with all the sort of flimflammery that accords him his status, but which he's inherited through a family line.
Absolutely.
He spends all his time just getting drunk and being bleary and having no wisdom, tribal or otherwise, at all.
Yeah, not a particularly endearing person. And actually, you know, to put it in the context of our society, it's sort of, you know, someone as largely dislikable and distant and aloof from his people living in poverty. I mean, he just lives in a hut on a beach as well. He only has a stereo system. It's not wealth as we would understand it, but in relative terms, he seems fantastically wealthy because he's got a stereo.
He's got a stereo, exactly.
But, like, that aloofness is, you know, is of a piece with, say, the Tory party or Theresa May in terms of, like, his kind of heart-on-hand concern for the people around him. So it is, and this is the sense in which I mean that sometimes this gaze of, like, indigenous wisdom can be patronising, because actually this is a society with structures no different to our own. Some of them are to be admired, and they're, you know, the oral tradition, the being at one with nature. Another one, such as quite a steep social hierarchy of the chief gets his say, despite not having earned it. I mean, he's a hereditary chief.
Yes, quite.
You know, it's not something that I would admire, and I think it's healthy that we don't have a structure such as that here. And I mean, equally, you might see a young pregnant woman rolling a palm leaf cigarette and smoking that, and, you know, you've got Western colonialism telling indigenous people what they should be doing, and that's obviously problematic, but you equally, smoking during pregnancy isn't a good thing. So it's kind of... You know, I feel ideally there's a balance in the middle of these things where this way of life, which is more down-to-earth and sustainable, we in the West have a lot to learn from that. And equally, there are advances of Western science and engineering that would be of use there. I mean, there's a diesel generator that comes on for a few hours every evening to provide electricity. I mean, why that's not a solar panel when it feels like it very easily could be a solar panel and battery? And it would make a great... and positive difference to living standards there, I think. So.
Okay. There's some one thing you stress in this book, and I really like it, is the objectification of this tribe, that actually they're a tourist draw for the tourism in the area. They're promoted by the local tourist board. Come and see our indigenous people. Come and see the Mokken. How do you feel about that? What did you learn about that in terms of what so many people are here for today, in fact, in terms of responsible travelling, responsible... educated, informed tourism?
Yeah, I mean, I think as tourists, as travellers, as adventurers, there are a lot of labels attached to these communities now. We do have a responsibility. I mean, the power of a passport is incredible, a Western passport, and the skipper of the boat, who features a lot in the book, white-skinned, born in Hampstead, but actually lived his life in Australia, having been a 10-pound pom in, like, 1953. He has a quite colonial racist attitudes, essentially, and a very strong white-skinned sense of, I show up on any beachhead in the world, I put down anchor and I'm welcome ashore. And he's got his Australian and his British passports that essentially guarantee his right to do that. Moken people crossing a naval boundary that has existed for like 50 years, where their way of life has existed for hundreds, for many centuries. The privilege that comes with being a traveller or a tourist from the West is enormous, and I think with that there is a responsibility. And when you look at the way that the Moken existence is packaged by the Thai government and the Thai tourist authorities, and you know, you might go down to a tourist booking agency in Phuket, and you'll see a placard or a sandwich board showing what's on sale, and you'll have sea turtles, you'll have moken, and you'll have hand gliding or bungee jumping,
right?
And you know, you've got people alongside sea turtles as if it's just an attraction, and it's firstly, it doesn't give these people the respect that they're due, and secondly, it sort of casts them as non-human in some way, which becomes very problematic when you see things like oil and gas industry drilling and exploring in that region, when you see trawlers and pair trawlers that will go sort of a kilometre apart with a net dragged between them, scouring the sea of all fish. If we're looking at the people that have lived in these areas and habitats, who are custodians of that habitat, as actually often the best way of protecting it.
They live sustainably.
They live sustainably, and I think our tourism, if it's going to exist to these places, really, it should happen in the right way. It's not to say it shouldn't happen, but ecotourism, responsible tourism,
I've sat on this stage before with a couple of people who have said, when you go to Africa, let's take Tanzania or Kenya, for example, do go to the wildlife sanctuaries, do go to the game reserves, because every dollar you spend there goes to fund, put petrol in the jeeps of the game wardens, pays the salary of security people and so on, and actually helps keep these places alive and keeps the wildlife alive. Did you get the same sense with the Moken? Are they in any way benefiting from interaction with tourists in Thailand or not?
I think it's hard to, where I was on Sudan, it's a very simple community.
Yeah.
Boats certainly arrive, bringing lots of tourists, and I was there in 2013, as I understand it, it's more and more every year. You know, there was, as I say, the Moken had a diesel generator that ran for a few hours a day, and they had food aid from the mainland that was a bag of rice. So there's certainly tourist dollars coming in, but whether or not that's staying in the local community and the extent to which it is, I think, I'm not an expert on it, but certainly there's basic infrastructure that could have been there, such as I say, some reliable, clean energy.
Right.
A lot of these things come down to the government structures that we have in these countries. I mean, Thailand is a dynastic monarchy.
Yes.
It's ruled in and out by military regime. There's very poor human rights record. There's incarceration of dissidents, and it's very interesting that we, as Westerners, none of that is in our relationship with Thailand. Our relationship with Thailand as a country is primarily beaches, coconuts, and a massage. I think tourism is, in essence, there's a big question of what is tourism to be, if it's part of, arguably, its greatest role is to make us better global citizens in some way. We are on the same earth. You know, we all have a vested interest in that earth, in it not being overrun by acidified oceans because of climate change, or plastic across every single beach, and the sort of mass tourism that you see in Thailand and Southeast Asia and lots of other places, I think it cuts to the heart of some questions about our own society here. I mean, why do we have a society here that people feel such an intense need to escape from, that young people need to go through a rite of passage where they go and get out of their head drunk on like antifreeze and iron brew or whatever mixed in a bucket on a beach in Thailand? It's what's missing in our own society that we've had to export that quite extreme need for freedom, and quite a warped sense of freedom as well, to a beach in what would be called the third world, where there aren't necessarily structures in place to absorb that healthily. And yeah, so it makes us look at ourselves and it makes us look at how we interact with these other countries, I think. And there are plenty of questions there.
Did you, I mean, you don't really explore this in the book, nor should you, I suppose, but did you get any sense from the Moken themselves about how they view being the objectified tribe that is that the tourists are coming to see? Do they play on it? Do they have a sense of it?
I think they do ever so slightly. They know sea gypsies. People want to come and see sea gypsies. But not any more than that. I mean, I don't think there's anything contrived there. I think mainly their sense is to be quite mystified that they are such a draw, that they are an attraction. I mean, they certainly think they live in paradise, and the beachhead of Surin is an absolutely beautiful, pristine place of rainforest high above it, and then maybe 50 or 100 stilt huts that line this gorgeous beach. So they certainly think it's paradise. But this sense that they're a custodians of a human spirit, of a purity of existence, of indigenous wisdom. They're much more humble than that, I think. Right. That's very much a Western imposition upon them, I'd say. And equally, the guy, the Luxemburger behind the film, who had this very romanticised sense of the Moken. You know, when we would have gone out on a boat, a kabang, which is the long-tail boat, with an outboard motor on the back, quite a rudimentary one, with like a scaffold pole for the tiller, firing it up and it's petrol-fired, and Reinhard, the producer, saying, "And why don't you use sailboats, traditional sailboats?" And they're like, "Petrol is easy." You know, so yeah, it's kind of, why would we sort of like hoist the mainsail and like stitch the frayed sail when we could just fire
start
up the engine
and off they go.
Yeah, so it's very much not playing to it. I think they're just trying to get along in a 21st century that's very difficult for their way of life.
Tell me about how, as a writer, this is the Travel Writing Festival, let's talk a bit about the writing and how, what happens in your mind, that alchemy of authorship, when you can see what you see these fantastic people who you are getting to know. As you said, you know, the pristine beach, the houses on stilts, the rainforest canopy up and above behind it. How you get that onto a page in a way that somebody sitting in a suburban drawing room in West London can suddenly picture themselves there and be transported to that? What is the trick? Is the awful question to ask. But
yeah, no, I'm happy to share the knowledge. I always want people. I like the idea of... I mean, writing, I see it as a very democratic thing. I think it's a great way to see the world around you, to reflect on it. And I think that's certainly a first part of it. I think a lot of the technology that we have in modern society that people become ever more reliant and addicted to kind of can really impede that ability to evoke, either as a writer or a reader, a scene in front of you. And so I think it's kind of important to try and keep out these distractions, especially digitalized distractions, to really sort of sit in a place and look.
Yes.
Like with maybe not silence, but not distractions, you know, not music, you know, to listen to the sounds of whether it's the cicadas or the crickets or the birds or the wind on the trees, you know, to really allow yourself to be immersed in that kind of landscape is, I think, important. And then I think to have a sort of faith in the written word as well, which I've always had. I always grew up reading avidly, and then probably from about the age of 10, writing quite avidly because I really wanted to be a writer. So, you know, I when I sit down to write, I have a sense of I as a reader want to write something that I would want to read and that others would want to read, and really believing that this is, you know, a really beautiful medium of communication, and all of the... highly distractive, kind of glamorized and heavily sort of commercialized products that are designed in such a way just to make us interact with them rather than to just be and to relax and to take in a scene. I feel that writing has something really beautiful to offer as an antidote to that, because it's, you know, it's on paper. Even if it's an ebook, I'd say it's not quite as good as paper, but that tactile relationship that people have with the page as a writer or a reader, I think that needs to be dear to you, and you need to take an enjoyment in the process of writing, in crafting your sentences, in thinking up a nice turn of phrase or a piece of imagery that just for whatever reason really works. So.
And do you write, I mean, different writers have different techniques. Do you take notes while you're in situ, while you're sitting there on the boat or on the beach? Do you stick down keywords? Do those nice phrases that come in the moment get put down on paper, and then you come back to wherever you live here in the UK and write it up? How does it work?
I think it's a bit of a mixture. I mean, again, like Laurie, the old sea captain in this, would occasionally have had the most amazing turn of phrase. You know, he's just a guy who's steeped in oral tradition. He's sailed around the world twice on a boat that he built himself.
Yeah.
And sometimes he'd just say something in the most magnificent way. Now I'm trying to think of him talking about the fact that you wouldn't navigate off Mercury because it's moving too fast in the sky, Jules. Yes. You know, all of that. And it's... he'd say something like that. Okay, I have to make a note of that because he'd have phrased it in such a way. Equally, when I'm actually talking to people, I don't like to intrude on it with... a camera is a very intrusive thing.
Yes, of course.
A notepad and pen. It's still a sense of I'm recording you.
Yes.
You know, in a very humble sense, but it's still like I'm putting you down. I'm making an exhibit of you in some way.
Quite.
So I'll often like discreetly do it later. Okay. And then I feel like I'm just fortunate in that my memory seems to be quite good. And a lot of people have asked me, where do you get this? Where do you get this from? And I think I'm starting to appreciate it more as slowly my memory gets ever so slightly less sharp. So maybe more notes will happen in the future.
Never there. You've got an extract you'd like to read for us. Would you mind taking us up? Would you like Julian to transport us to a beach in Western Thailand?
Where we got? Yeah. Okay, so this is essentially just watching the beach and watching the world in the way that the Mokken people do and have done for centuries. On the upright of a nearby hut, a gecko waited. The suckers of its feet stuck faithfully to the bamboo so that the creature pointed back down towards the earth, while a line of ants made their way respectfully around the perimeter of its spread limbs and tail. A small lizard, dark green but with yellow splashed down one side, scurried over a rock and onto the earth, pulling a grub from the soil and jerking it backwards into its throat. The point of its jaw fastened shut, and then the hard line of its head seemed to my human eyes, and for just a single moment, to hold the slightest grin along its tiny, razor-edged teeth. The lizard's tongue was put away, and it climbed back to its rock, rubbing the side of its head against the surface, so that the scales of its skin sang softly with the sound of abrasion, and an opaque black ball of its eye moved close over the stone. So long and so closely I watched it all, contextualizing and considering their moves on my terms. The animals did not really wait, for waiting required time, and also a purpose being awaited, and both were constructs of which they must have been unaware. Eventually, my mind wandering, I grew almost uncomfortable with my voyeurism, unnerved as if some creature were maybe observing me with similar intent. Perhaps a snake was keeping a watching brief on my position, maybe an eagle high overhead. Or was my brain really it? Are we the upwards extremity in examination of life on earth? Consciousness and thought felt somehow sinister, almost as if it was an ulterior motive in that place where most things worked with existence and survival. Could it have been that in all that jungle of life so vast and so diverse, ours was the limit of thought, with humans the end point of all the world's consciousness? If indeed that were so, how could we ever be equal to such a great responsibility?
Nicely read. Nice, beautifully written, Julian. Thank you. Do you think the Mokken can survive in a world such as this? You are very clear when you are writing about the injustices of living in that part of the world, both politically, socially, and economically. I mean, the stories you say of twin trawlers with a huge net between them, basically scouring the bottom of the seabed. For a first people, an indigenous people who live from the sea, on the sea, and of the sea, this is death to them, surely.
Yeah. I mean, climate change alone is causing rises in ocean temperature of a scale that's disastrous for fish stocks on which the Mokken have survived. And the Mokken story is an interesting one anyway, because the life has always been hard. I mean, one of the women who we met on Phuket, who's Mokken, there's a small Mokken community on Phuket, and she took us almost as a guide back to Surin, the original island where her ancestors would have come from. And she, this is Thailand that we're talking about right now, but she would have been from Myanmar, but actually would have left Myanmar at a time when it was still called Burma.
Yeah.
And as a refugee from the civil war, one of the many civil wars that occurred there throughout the 20th century, you know, and she talked about them stitching clothes made from plastic fertilizer sacks and using, you know, the metal canisters for engine oil cut open as cooking pots. So life for the Moken really is a constant series of hardships. Life has never been easy, and yet there's an ability, because of this sense of living at one with the world and not really requiring much beyond your natural environment to sustain you, there's an ability to be happy, there's an ability to be philosophical about change and, well, it's always just hard. And so in some ways it's interesting with a society that isn't so concerned about anything beyond the immediate or not the future in the sense that we as a society have so much mapping and forecasting and analysis and a real sense of what climate change is doing and is going to do. And, you know, fortunately there are energy companies now that you can buy renewable electricity from in your bills, and, you know, there are these everyday things that people, consumer choices and changes that we can make to improve our impact, to lessen our impact. Given our sort of great sort of demand that our society places on the world's resources, I think a lot is left to us to think about how can we reduce that impact, you know, whether it's, you know, having these tuna being plucked out of the ocean and then turned into cat food, and you see the cat as a nice internet meme or something like that, and, like, you know, when you're at the end of the day in an office, I'm not sort of impervious to a cute cat any more than the next person is. But, you know, these ways of living that we have that are so innocent, or the avocado on toast. I mean, I like avocado, but, you know, there's a gallon of water. South American water goes into every avocado, and I think what our society does need to have a greater thought about what our impact is. I think one of the sad things, actually, is that so many people here in the West would actually like to live a life that is better, that is more traditional. They'd like to have time to repair things rather than throw them away and buy a new one. They'd like to, you know, as Jeremy Corbyn with an allotment would sort of attest, you know, there is this sense of actually people want to get closer to nature. We're kind of kept from it. Which is, as I say, another kind of interesting phenomena within our relationship with tourism. We have these doses of nature, almost, rather than tearing up some car parks in a city and planting trees and turning London into a national park, or, you know, reimagining our world in the way that actually we'd like it to be. We export all of that kind of really special utopian value of how the world could be. We export it, and we compartmentalize it into 10-day or 2-week trips once a year, if we're lucky. So, and this is the thing, I think a lot of tourism is sold as the world here and then the world out there. And it's not in here and out there. I mean, I think Thailand's like 6,000 miles away. Two people are sitting in a roof in Thailand, opposite one another in chairs, no different to you or I right now. And there isn't really the strict walls between the two places that the tourism industry often throws up. And we should be imagining our own world in the best way, rather than this escapism that sometimes I think predominates.
So are you saying we need to be much more careful about the tourism that we do? That all of us here, looking at these fantastic holidays that are on offer, we need to be conscious of the responsibility of that? I mean, it's a small aside, but the World Economic Forum in Davos was happening last week. I'm sure you're aware. There's a fantastic historian that stood up and said, I am here for the first time at the World Economic Forum in Davos, where I'm seeing 1,500 private jets flying in to listen to David Attenborough talk about the death of our civilization and the killing of virtually every living human being on Earth. Can anybody please explain to me this contradiction?
I mean, it is staggering, and that was apparently a record amount of private jets on the flight path into Davos this week. I mean, I think one of the good things about Davos is that fewer people bothered going, whether that's leaders or protesters. It is losing its influence,
right?
Because it is a parody of itself. You know, we have a world where, like, 25 blokes have the same amount of money as 50% of the world's population.
25 people that own over 50...
they're all blokes, it's important, I think.
They are blokes, actually, quite. 25 men own over 50% of the world's resources.
Yeah.
Which is...
And it's not going to work. I mean, those numbers just don't work. That's so out of kilter with anything that could resemble balance. And
bring it back to a more manageable scale for me, and I'm a very small brain. How can we travel resourcefully and responsibly?
Yeah, I mean equally, I don't want to preach at anyone. I think there are people working hard, and we're in a culture where you do just want to go to warm weather and away to a beach. I understand where that comes from. I mean, speaking personally for myself, the holidays and the travel that I've most loved, that has meant most to me as a human, was cycling. Like, the first time I got on a ferry with my bicycle and cycled across France and discovered bakeries in every town, or cycling through Italy and deciding that I don't have any pistachio ice cream in this place, I'm going to try the next gelateria down the road, and there's two gelaterias and one of them does have pistachio. It's kind of these kind of small joys and these small moments, which actually even in I think the big, well-packaged and often quite expensive holiday, it's not the luxuriant thing that actually appeals most to our sense of spirit and what we were looking for and what we wanted. It's the random act of kindness where things didn't go according to plan. So I think people, it's great to be able to embrace that. And sometimes that's found closer to home. I mean, not going so far. A short-haul flight has a much smaller carbon imprint than a long-haul flight. I think, I just met my publisher earlier, and he said that one of the members of staff said he doesn't want a pay rise, he wants a four-day week instead. So it's kind of, there are so many different choices that, as a society, we've become conditioned not to take, because there's so much, we're so geared towards, earn more money. Yes. And then spend it, actually, ironically. Spend it to end up repairing the harm we've done to our souls. By earning more money. So I think, it's not for me to tell anyone what's right or wrong. But one of the great things about travel is often it does create the space for us to reappraise and reflect.
Exactly. Can we just... I know you may not want to talk too much about it, but you've just come back from a cycling trip around the Middle East. Tell us why you went and what you saw and what you were doing.
I rode a bicycle. I mean, a bicycle is always my foremost medium.
Quite. You and I both.
Yeah, without a windscreen or a television screen or a smartphone screen, it's an unmoderated way of looking at the world. And I think Israel and Palestine, and particularly the Palestinians at this moment, for one, there's a nice community around the world of bicycles. So meeting with Palestinian guys who can't go on bike rides because they're afraid of soldiers at checkpoints. Young Israeli conscripts manning checkpoints in the occupied Palestinian territories and harassing them for riding their bikes. And so this very sort of human thing that has actually been the biggest part of my independence, I think, as a person who's riding a bicycle as a young man out of a small town in the Midlands. And getting this sense of independence to meet people that aren't able to do that because of Israeli military policy. I mean, I find it very difficult. So that's really the story of the next book that I'm working on, and it's how bicycles, also on the Israeli side, because there are Israeli activists who are disgusted by the conduct of their government and who want a Middle East and want an Israel and a Palestine where Arabs and Jews and white people are living together and in a sort of a balanced, non-racist society. But equally meeting Eritrean people who are sort of black Africans to Israel who also encounter racism specifically because they're not white. So it's kind of seeing this society a very up-close way and hearing the stories at the roadside, really.
You know, it's funny to mention, have you been to Eritrea?
No.
Anybody here been to Eritrea? Asmar, isn't it marvellous? Both Julian and I have a shared fascination in cycling, so forgive this riff off. My first trip to Eritrea back in the mid-90s, I was astonished to find there's a huge cycling community in Eritrea.
Massive
road races from Asmara down to Massawa through the Danlal Depression, largely because it used to be Italian Somaliland. The Italians took a lot of bikes. Left them there. It's extraordinary.
I mean, the bicycle is just wonderful. There's a women's cycling team in Afghanistan. There's a Rwanda national cycling team.
I mean,
more bicycles.
Tell us, what was the quality of roads in and around Palestine, Jerusalem?
Yeah, I mean, Israel is, you know, it's like a Western state in terms of generally asphalt everywhere, like very well kept asphalt. Palestine often really good as well. I mean, and actually, it's one of the ways in which you see the occupation in the roads, because if you've got something like the resorts on the Dead Sea, which is right in occupied Palestine, and actually that would be, you know, the Israelis take it and they have set up a resort on the Dead Sea. They're charging people £20, 80 shekels, whatever it might have been, to go and get covered in mud from the Dead Sea and then have a shower. And that's a very rich country, Israel is, and that's Palestinian land with what could be a sustainable tourism
for Palestinian
people. And this is the equivalent of Germany taking Biarritz from the French and having a highway running to Biarritz in terms of where each place sits within the territories of each country. So you will get a good road going through the Palestinian territories to this resort.
Quite.
But Palestinians might not be allowed to drive even on some of these roads, despite the fact that it cuts through their land, cut down their olive trees maybe, to put it in place, and takes tourists to a resort in Palestinian territory from which Palestinians are getting no benefit whatsoever. And again, it's like the landscape doesn't lie is kind of my medium in terms of the way I approach stuff.
The landscape doesn't lie. We've got time for a couple of quick questions. If anybody has a question for Julian on anything to do with cycling or the Mokin. Yes, please. Thank you, Roddy.
I was in Surin in about 2002.
Right.
And it was a national park at that point.
Yeah.
And the National Park Service was operating under a lot of constraints, but they were doing their best to try and keep things reasonably balanced.
Yeah.
And my impression at that point was the big problem was actually the tourists and their behavior, because at that stage they had an underwater snorkeling trail to display the wonders of the sea, and it was pretty well destroyed by visitors who had basically walked on it, decided that the rules didn't apply to them, etc. What's the National Park Service like now? How are they doing?
Yeah, I mean, we had a similar experience of our boat being moored and having a ranger coming round on a speedboat to make sure that the anchor was attached to the buoy rather than just being dropped at random. But, you know, it was one boat with two guys on it, so it's certainly under-resourced. And I think they're trying to do their best with limited resources. But cheap flights from, say, India and China have also opened these areas up to tourism. Yeah. So people would fly to Phuket, I guess, and take a boat trip. But so the numbers of people coming in, and actually the expectations, you know, as you say, there's this very sort of sense of a pure paradise experience, and every human has an impact, essentially. So it's more and more for a very small team of park service to manage.
They're
still trying, yeah.
Thank you. Do you have any more questions? Nope. Please, Roddy. You're allowed.
May I ask how conscious you are when you meet people of how you put yourself across, both in terms of what you wear, what you've got with you? Because I'm conscious, I've read about Surin and the sort of not standoffish, not welcoming, not effusive, but not hostile either. How you bridge that, just as you might with a lorry driver in America or lorry in Surin. How do you make yourself friendly?
You slowly become an experienced traveller, I suppose, and so body language being important, a smile is always helpful. Like, it's amazing the universalism of like raising a hand or something. But speaking to the main cameraman on this trip, he was often quite envious of the fact that the tools of my trade are like a notepad and a pen. I can have it in a back pocket, whereas he's there hulking like pelly cases and backpacks, and it's much more intrusive. So it's one of the things I love about writing and the written word, of how much less intrusive it is. And then beyond that, I think it's just kind of the being open, unafraid, and curious in a respectful way of what you're meeting, the people you're meeting, and you know, the basics of always trying to learn how to say hello and thank you. And yeah, I guess everyone figures out their own ways, really. But do I de-westernize myself? In terms of what? Are we talking about, like, local dress? No. I think in some respects, I am always a Westerner. I mean, I'm half Turkish as well, so actually in the Middle East it's a little bit different. But in an indigenous setting like Surin, you are an outsider and sort of own that fact respectfully. I think there's something to be said for that approach, probably.
Last question from me, Julian. Is there anywhere you have a Bernie ambition to go to that you're building up to?
The other week I was back home in the Midlands and Mum was showing me old photo albums, and there's a very, very cute photo of me in a pair of yellow dungarees, aged about 3, standing on a chair, and I loved maps. There was a map on the wall and I'm pointing very determinedly at Patagonia.
At Patagonia?
I'm like, I'm this big. And, and I did always think I was going to cycle through Latin America, and I would love to, so yeah, maybe Latin America at some point. There is a real sense that would be amazing.
That'd be good destiny, wouldn't it? From 3 years old to...
And the Atacama, I've always loved deserts, so cycling through a desert is kind of generally where I'm at my happiest.
Have you cycled? Yes, you have cycled the desert.
I've cycled through like the edge of the Taklamakan and Gobi deserts of Central Asia. I've cycled through the Sonoita of Mexico, US.
Quite.
And then Wadi Rum... the deserts of the Middle East a little bit. So, yeah, I've got a few.
You've got a few. Hit this. Julian will be signing his book over at the Stanford's book signing tent. I highly recommend it to you. For those of you that haven't seen it yet, it looks like that. It's quite easy to spot on the bookshelves. You will not be wasting your money. It's a fantastic read, and he's very, very good at taking you there when you're just sitting in an armchair. So please... please do go and buy it. Thank you very much for coming. There'll be another show up, I think, in half an hour or so. Would you please give huge thanks to Julian Serre? Thank you.
Thank you very much.